So let me start by saying who we are, because we are sort of a newcomers on the block. Mathematical Sciences Publisher is a nonprofit organization created by University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Warwick in the UK, with the sole intent of moving large content produced by both universities over to the web, and in a faster way that the established arrangement was doing it so at that time. And we are a fairly small organization. We have 27 people working for us in the US, most of them in Berkeley, California. We have 5 in the UK. We do most of our typesetting in Egypt and Brazil. And we also publish 2 of the top 3 cited journals in mathematics. This is Annals of Mathematics and Geometry and Topology right now. And we also our readership is 72% online only, which means these people are intently taking subscription to the journals and not taking print, and in a lot of cases not taking any breaks in the price. For example, with Annals, this is a journal that does not give any break in the price for somebody that does not want to receive print, but even so, large amount of subscribers in the US and Europe right now are taking the subscription electronic only in order to avoid management of the paper content. And mostly because of that, we have invested quite a bit of time in trying to produce an electronic product which is more useful to the reader, mm-hmm. because we know that our readers are taking most of the products electronic in all electronic only format. We're also the producers of 2 workflow systems that we use in house for the production, for the editorial management of our journals and for the production of the journals, which we do license outside. EditFlow is the product that we use for the managing of the editorial flow system. Is right now managing all the submissions at the American Mathematics Society, and pretty soon it's also going to be managing the submissions at the European Math Society. With 3 installations in the world, 1 in Berkeley, 1 in Providence, Rhode Island, and another 1 in Switzerland. What I'm mostly going to talk about today is the other one, which is TypeFlow, which is what we use in order to manage the typesetting and moving this content fast onto the web. EditFlow is right now used to manage the top 5 4 of the top 5 cited journals in mathematics: JAMS, Journal of the AMS, BAMS, the Bulletin of the AMS, Annals in Geometry and Topology. And if I have my way with Steve, I'm going to do 5 out of 5 pretty soon. So a little bit about EditFlow. We do a few peculiar things on EditFlow. One of them is, and those are pretty much stuff that's very peculiar that we do, but Elsevier and Springer Verlag and Editorial Flow don't quite do it. One of them is unique author identification. Every single person in our database, be either an author, a referee, an editor, or anybody that shows up in a reference into any article, is entered that in a unique way and classified in a unique way. We have a lot of help on obtaining this unique ID, most of them coming from working very close to math reviews, which were up to this point the sole people doing unique author ID in science. There are lots of other people trying to achieve unique author ID. Most notable developments in this area are being done right now by Crossref, which is trying to start up a project by which they will assign every scientist a unique number by which they can use and can be identified and so forth, so forth. The reasons for doing so is manifold. We are able to do a permissions layer on top of our editorial flow system, which is able to identify someone and know if he's allowed to see a particular report that comes into the editorial flow system or not. Let me see if I can bring up a screen in here. Bear with me for a second. So for example, this is a, see, this is the screen we're right now going on the editorial flow system for the Pacific Journal. And what you see in there is the managing editor, Varadarajan, which is able to touch and see any of the articles which are in here, and then take any of the actions that you would normally expect on a standard production system. And a standard editorial system, you can, you know, do all the normal tasks, and you can also sort of ask for a referee, you know, one of the possible tasks in there, and you can list the referees that have worked for you, and get sort of a close up on how they're working. You can see that this guy here has done a lot of work. mostly test work, but you can see that you know, this particular guy here has defaulted on a couple of papers that he was supposed to submit a report. He did return a report. This particular other guy here has not returned any report in any time, and you can see some very briefly stats on how soon this particular guy is able to return a report, and you can even see, let's see if I can pull up one in here. Sort of a conflict of interest. So William Heiser in here is a conflict of interest for this particular paper in some way. This particular journal does not allow, for example, you to ask anyone that has written a paper with any of the authors in the last 5 years to be a referee for this particular article. And also does not allow students and advisors relationship in the referee either, going as long as 10 or 15 years, I believe. I'm not so sure what's the time limit in here. And we are automatically probing math reviews to get the distance in between those two people, and we automatically also probing the genealogy database in order to find out the relationships and point to them. The journal, this is configurable on a per journal basis, so a journal an editorial manager can decide what to do with a conflict of interest. He can just point a conflict of interest and not do anything. He can prevent the assignment. In this particular case here, the Pacific Journal is preventing the assignment, and this particular person is not allowed to referee for that particular journal. And we also do a few other, you know, peculiar things. Let me see if I can go back to my slides. How do we go back there? Okay. And we also have a wealth of acceptance procedures, because when I first started talking to these people, we didn't have an editorial flow system. And I was pretty much with the choice of looking at several options that were out there and deciding what to use. And I couldn't really cover the gap that existed between the editors themselves and what those systems were able to do. And mostly on this particular area here, which was the acceptance. In order to be able to follow what editors do and not change the way that they would accept or reject the paper, we had to go and implement that ourselves. So EditFlow right now has about 13 different ways that you can accept an article or reject an article. You can accept an article being an editor, if the journal would allow you so. You can accept an article by an editor making a recommendation to the managing editor, and the managing editor accepting or rejecting. You can vote on a paper. The whole editorial board can vote on a paper. The vote can be in many different ways. It can be a majority vote. That's the case of argument number theory. The vote may have to be a unanimous vote. That's the case of the Journal of the AMS, GEMS. and the vote may be a board vote. Board vote is a vote where one proposes, another one seconds, and then one objects in the space of 30 days, for example. And that is the scheme for acceptance and rejection for geometry and topology. And so right now, I mean, in the beginning, this was a very painful process because every single editor I talked to would come up with a new way to accept the paper and a new way to reject the paper. And we just had to go back to the drawing board. Now, with all the 13 possibilities implemented in there, it's just a question of choosing whatever you want to use, and you can have the system working for you in the next minute. And in the case, for example, of a board vote, when a particular editor is ready to make a recommendation, he can just click on a single button. That letter is composed, is sent to the whole board, and the boards then are prompted to vote. They can vote by email. They can vote by logging into their interface and voting yes or no. And the decision on the paper is done automatically after a certain amount of time. The process is pretty painless at this time. But what I mostly want to talk about is, first of all, why did we get involved with restoration of tugboat to begin with? I have to say that because of this framework, because of this unique author ID, and because of this database in the bank, it makes restoration of journals a breeze. I have to say that for every single author that is in there, he has many identifiers. You know, he has addresses. Working addresses. Some people prefer to put their home addresses in there, and whatever they give to us is whatever we put in there. But they're mostly identified by their email set. So this is a set within the database. It's a table within the database that associates an email to each one of the people in the database, and also the frame of time that particular email was used. So I'm entered there. I'm in the particular database myself with about something like 8 emails, and it says D'Souza@ucbvax.berkeley.edu, which worked from 1983 to 1985, and then from 1986 to 1992, I had a different address, and it has my Gmail address and so forth, and also my preferred email address. So when you come in and make a submission, as you would normally do with any journal, an Elsevier or Springer or in here, we'll ask you for your email address. And if we have that particular email address and we know when it was the first time that it was used and the last time it was used, we may be able to classify you. And if we can't classify you, we'll open your record for you. And one of our librarians would deal with merging your record with an existing record or finding you in math reviews later on. For the restoration of Tugboat, we had to do a lot because we didn't have the benefit of many authors coming from math reviews. We did have quite a few that have written math papers and papers on Tugboat, but that was on the order of, I think, about 200, 250 max. And I think the authors of Tugboat are on the order of 2,800 right now. In order to get email subsets, in order to identify these people, was quite hard. But mining the mailing lists, mining comp.tech.tech was a very, very nice minefield, and we took many of them out of there, and people like Nelson Beebe, for example, is classified in there with emails that go back to 1981, 1982, and so on. And the other one, this was my own interest in reading Tugboat. I have almost never managed to place my hands on a particular article of Tugboat with less than half an hour of wanting it because of never knowing what my password really was. The algorithm is really draconian. My standard password for that kind of stuff is a language on my mother's tongue, which is in 2P, which doesn't have a written record, and Tugboat's algorithm wouldn't allow it.
I don't remember this, but anyway, go ahead. We'll have to talk again after.
The fact is that, with many, many websites asking for a login and passwords, I personally have a problem with that because, pretty soon I'm going to give the same as Wells Fargo Bank,
and somebody out there will know my login and my password elsewhere. So and there are also a difference in the way that I read TED-Bulletin and the way that I read some other articles. When I do read, for example, Annals of Mathematics, and I do read JAMS, the Journal of the MS, quite frequently, and but I plan on it, and I kind of take the paper with me home. I put it in my backpack, or I put it in my knapsack, and I take it home and I read it sometime later on. But that's never the issue with TED-Bulletin, because I never know what I'm going to need. And TED-Bulletin needs to be kind of searched, and then when the article is produced, then I want to put my hands on that. And most of the time, I get prompted to go there and pick up an article because of an email from somebody else. And especially within our organization, we have to support about 20 full-time people which are working on editing, and they have a little problem here and a little problem there. And I do remember have seen this about 1998 and so forth, and I want to dig an article here or there, and it becomes a real problem. And what we're proposing here is that you will be served by your IP address. So if your institution subscribe, you can just go in and download the article just as you would with Annals, with Bulletin of the MS, or any other journal, and not be hampered by having to have logins and passwords in order to do fetch an article. So so moving over, which I'm supposed to be talking about here, is exactly kind of flow, not edit flow. What do we do when an article is accepted? Well, when an article is accepted, then TypeFlow gets to hear about it for the first time, and edit flow is over at that point in time. But then we use the same structure of the metadata that has been built in over time. I mean, this article, before being accepted, in general, has gone through revisions, subsequent revisions. The author has been asked to do many uploads. At every time the author makes an upload, he gets to see how his name is spelled out, how his address is spelled out, and he has a chance of correcting many things. And in general, we get high quality metadata at the end of that process. And at this particular time, at the time of acceptance, he has to make his upload of sources, and at that time he gets one of his final checks on the quality of the metadata. His entire metadata is exposed at that particular time, and if there are any questions about his ID, those questions are asked at that particular point in time. He can identify himself by his advisor and his thesis. He can identify himself through other means, and then we proceed pushing his paper to go through approval process and the sources approval process, and then go into editing. The other big interesting thing that we do in here that I was not able to see in any other workflow tool for typesetting is that we have a tight integration between the database and the file system that is being worked with the paper. So that if at that particular point in time, when the author makes an upload of sources, the first metadata file, the initial metadata file, is built for that particular paper, and it's pretty much like the example that Kaveh have shown in here. For his own system, it's very structured, and it's the sole source that's used in order to build the whole content for the metadata for the paper. So most papers in mathematics have a backslash author and an author name, backslash title and a title name, backslash address and an address in there, which are sort of three pieces of metadata. We have about 200 pieces of metadata which get built with every paper, and they go contain the whole history of the file, classification of the author by first name, middle name, last name, and addresses and emails and so forth. And this metadata, we place this metadata inside the tag file because at that particular point in time, the production editor is going to have a close contact with the author for a long period of time while the paper is being produced. And if there's any change, if there are any changes, if, for example, John Willard Milner would like to be known as J.W. Milner, he will express his feelings at that particular point in time. And the production editor is likely the first person to get that particular information, and he will introduce that information on the paper. And in most systems, which are used in most publishing houses around the world, that makes into that paper, and then that's the end of it. And with the system that we're working right now,
that makes into the paper and then filters back into the database, because every change that's made into the text sources at that time is reacquired by the database on a daily basis. And the particular production editor has to confirm those changes. I mean, is this guy really wanted to be known as J.W. Milner as opposed to John Willard Milner? And if the production editor confirms such, and it will be filtered there and it will be used on subsequent papers. The other thing that we do is a full cross-linking of our bibliography. I'm not so sure you, many of you have had the chance of seeing some of the papers that we do. Let me pick it up, one of them here. Okay. And so, and let's go down to current issues and get one particular paper in there, and I'll get the screen version of this part. Oh God, it looks like Notre Dame is not paying their bills.
You're on through Notre Dame, right?
Huh?
You're on through the Notre Dame network, unless you're doing VPN.
I expected that they were subscribing to the annals. So let's get this paper some other way.
They could provide it to their faculty, but specially exclude IP numbers given to the guests.
Let's hope they're doing that instead of not paying their bills. I have one in here. Okay, so this one will be fine. So
one of the things that we provide immediately right away with every single paper is an identification of where this paper, this particular paper, has been published, because we deal with both authors and editors and so forth that have a very open mind on where the paper should be and where it should be located and so forth. So many of those papers, you are able to find those papers in the archive, and many of the authors do take the care of taking the published papers and depositing the archive, even after the fact that they have been published with the annals and with several other journals like Geometry and Topology and so forth. So we do provide an identification right away that says, you know, even to people which are on the archive, that this particular journal, this particular paper has appeared on volume July 2009, volume 170 and 1. And if you walk in here, you'll see, let's increase this a little bit, you would see that the paper is naturally fully linked inside, so that if you read in here and you want to go to FAL 84, then you throw into the bibliography at that particular location, and you can see what that particular reference really is. But not only that, each one of you can see that there's a lot of blue items in here, and each one of those bibliography items here are actively linked to where that particular resource is anywhere in the world, be either with Springer, Elsevier, Edson Wesley, John Wiley, whatever. So that if you come in here, for example, and you click on any of those articles which are sort of any of those titles which are, you know, have a blue link, I think it's going to open over here. We can go in there. And yes, this is the particular article that is cross-linked there. To do this, we do exactly what Nelson B. has explained in here in the talk yesterday. We have the entire database of all the citations of all the journals in the database, and via, you know, the unique author ID of our publication database. And so Don Knuth, even though he shows up on Tugboat, spelled, I think, in 17 different ways, he is uniquely identified as a one single person in all his books and the translations of his books and so forth
are pointing directly to that. His name does indeed show up differently in several different publications, and we do have, you know, the name as appeared in several different publications, but it makes it a lot easier to find something and not have to mine for the location more than once.
Why we did this in a database form, I was mentioned to Nelson, as because we do mine databases worldwide for the location of those sources on a daily basis. We do mine Crossref, Zentralblatt, Math Reviews, and Google Books for the locations of those particular books on the databases, and this is updated in the database and then filters back into the PDF file, which is reprocessed every night and made available. So you're much better by pointing to a resource which is on Mathematical Sciences Publisher web server rather than making a copy of it and taking it over to your own live server. Because if you come back tomorrow, you may find a better file. Most files circa 5 years ago were about 40% linked. Most of our files right now are in the ups of 90 to 95% linked to the original resources online. And that's why I harass Carl very frequently about reprocessibility. I find this to be essential. Maybe that's just me. And the other issue is trying to produce the best output that we can out there. We built in into our workflow the production of EPUB, and which you have seen already being shown by quite a few people, including Kaveh. Except that Kaveh's workflow moved from EPUB all the way to TAC so that he can generate it on the iPod and show all this different beauty. We will start offering January 1st our publications in EPUB format. I don't know if you've been following up, but there is a flurry of activity on EPUB right now, mostly because every single newsroom in the country has a programming group trying to develop some form of EPUB reader for their newspapers. And the most beautiful ones that I have seen is this one is running on Adobe Digital Editions, which allow you to have a library here on the left side, and this is produced straight out of TAC with the beautiful work of our late Eitan Gurari, and you can sort of resize it. Let me see if I can do this. And have line breaks, which are okay. They're not as good as TAC. You can see it here. We are working with these people and working in trying to produce EPUB that will do better line breaks and better output. But you know, this is very, very readable. And one of the reasons why references by page number have to go and have to disappear, because you can increase the font size on this article and page breaks don't make any sense in here. Other readers which are being developed in the same frame are like one of the ones that I like the most is the New York Times. It's this particular one here, which is the version 2 of their reader, which also using the EPUB format is beautifully done. It's in fact one of the best ways to read the New York Times right now. You can see the diagramming. Page breaks are. Line breaks are fairly nicely done, and the rendering is also very beautiful. This one is done on Adobe Atmosphere platform, and programming all by the New York Times. And there are many other ones like this. There are people doing renders which are even working things like Flash. And I guess you take whatever your programmer knows how to do and make a reader on that. But the beauty of it is that all these people are sort of a little bit eerie of what Jeff Bezos is doing. And so they're moving to a standard. And the EPUB is very, very fast becoming a standard. And the fact that Tangurari's work is able to produce EPUB straight out of TAC is very, very, very beautiful. Because this entire archive of material that we have over the last 20 or 30 years will be very easily translatable into ebooks.
So I wanted to move quickly over to the very end. How does this impact, the textbook restoration? As I said, it made it a lot easier because we had, this database. We started with David Walden and Carl Berry's work and into so far called capsule files, and which they have kept the metadata for TechVote for 30 years. And I start writing the translator at that time. What really happened in there is that Carl gave me the files but didn't give me the email address for David. And so I was left on the weekend with the files and no email address, so I didn't have anybody to ask anything, so I did it later myself. And I look at the first file, TechVote number one. I said, this is going to be a breeze. It's going to take me 10 minutes to do the whole thing. And then I found that in volume two, there was another metadata issue. And then I extended my translator. And then on volume three, there was another metadata issue. And then I said, let me start with volume 30 and go backwards. And then when it took me about 2 hours to write one that read the metadata in volume 30, and then we walked backwards and had a beautiful set of XML metadata that we could handle and insert into the database. It wasn't that rosy because you have this Polish and Czech authors and TechVote, they have to have their names transliterated in UTF-8 and properly alphabetically ordered in the right place. And so after our librarians finished that, we had something that was manageable and you could look at. I have to say that everybody that works in our organization is asked to donate 2 hours of work per week to a worthy cause, and which makes it like a day a month. And we filled this in with several different things. We're still wiring, elementary schools in the area and doing all sorts of things. And we get one day a month off of the office and go participate in some worthy project. And there were many graphics designers and librarians that worked for us that were quite happy to use their time doing it at home on TechVote instead of having to go to do something somewhere else. So the author data is 3,329 authors, in fact. We have 2,857 articles. They have all been converted from TEC to UTF-8. We have made 2,000 DOI deposits so far on behalf of TUG, and we have about 900 to go. And those 900 to go are doubts about identification of authors and so forth, which are slowly being resolved by one librarian in Berkeley. And as soon as we get positive ID that we confident that is okay, then we'll proceed with the DOI deposit at that particular time. Things to be done. There's a lot of core-specific metadata. Was learning about new process to accept articles and to reject articles back in the beginning of this whole project. This year I learned a lot about extra fields of metadata that I have never heard about. We have the author metadata, the abstract and everything, but with TechVote we have, a classification by difficulty level, and we also have subsections. And the subsections have appeared with different names throughout the times. And so we're also developing some reasonable classification schemes that we can have subsections that have showed up with nearby names to be the same thing in order to make the classification and the search a little bit easier. The unique author ID here allows you to, for example, list all the articles of one particular author in TechVote. Which is something that Springer Verlag and Elsevier has been unable to provide up to this date. We also want to do the abstracts of as many papers as we can, and this is going to require a bit of work. and a bit of author interaction as well, in order to make sure that this is done correctly and this is sort of proofread. We also want to do the references at some point, and my proposal here is that moving forward that we always do it, and backwards we may not be able to do all of it because of the amount of work involved. So there is a lot of work to do, and I wanted to just briefly show you, I guess, I have some experimental cover on it because we still have not been able to get a good graphics on the press, but Barbara promised that she'll do some work for us on that, and I guess I should say sorry that ZTAC is not here, but should. And if you go to, you know, current issue or whatever, then you'll get, you know, your normal content. But everything that's going on here is XML. So if you want to change this particular left column here to the right or do any version you want, that is fairly easy to do. And TechBolt can choose how its journal is presented to the world. This is what we call the default view. And I guess you can see, Jonathan, is there a way to write ZTAC in UTF-8?
Yeah.
How?
I guess you can't do lowered E, it's just directly in UTF-8.
And reflected?
Reflected, yeah, that exists as UNICAD characters.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. The only E reflected I could get was in this pretty bad font. So that's why if you can concentrate on the other aspects, on the other more beautiful aspects of this page rather than on the defects. But you can sort of see a preview of it at the particular URL in there, pgm.math.berkeley.edu/techboat. Give us your input, you know, what you think that should go in there. And I really want to thank all of you here because, you know, when I see those faces in here, I now much more easily identify you with a previous paper that has showed up on TechBolt. So I'd like to thank you for your contribution to TechBolt. And I want to ask you to do one more step, to go back to your institution and ask your institution to subscribe to TechBolt. As an institutional subscriber. Because in that way, you'll be able to have quick access. You'll be able to click on an article here and get the PDF file immediately in front of you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Maybe just one short question as well. Yeah,
I'd like to make a statement. You mentioned that you took a file that Carl and I did, a bunch of files,
right.
And converted them to this.
Right.
I'd like to mention we took 25 years of files that Barbara had done, converted them into the format that he got.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work which had gone on already.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to be able to stand on top of that work. We do have one particular member of our department that has a full collection of TechBolt, Ken Ribet. He's a long, long time subscriber. And he offered me all of it so that we can look at the metadata. And I said, you have to realize that the metadata for TechBolt is way more intricate. You know, TechBolt sometimes have 4 snippets or 5-6 snippets of an article in the same page. So it is not like Annals where you enter the title and one author and you're going to find the next title in the next author 150 pages down the line. You may find the next article, the next author, about 3 lines down from that. And stuff which is as obscure as the CDC report sites and so forth, which ought to be preserved. And ought to be dealt in a searchable way, because if we decide that we're going to treat one particular article in one way, we're going to treat all articles in that particular way. And I'm very, very grateful to be able to stand on the top of the work that you two did. That was very nice. Yeah. And which is in the way, you know, work that Barbara did, which is Thank you.
Thank you.